There's been speculation that I was involved in the events that occurred, the freeway and the rooftop.
I'm sorry, Mr. Stark, but do you honestly expect us to believe that that was a bodyguard in a suit that conveniently appeared, despite the fact that...
I know that it's confusing. It is one thing to question the official story and another thing entirely to make wild accusations or insinuate that I'm a superhero.
I never said you were a superhero.
Didn't? Mm-mm. Well, good, because that would be outlandish and fantastic. I'm just not the hero type, clearly, with this laundry list of character defects, all the mistakes I made, largely public. Yeah, okay, yeah. Truth is, I am Iron Man.
I did not want to get this field because it had a huge 150-acre, 180-acre dead spot right in the middle of it.
Wow.
And for the last 20 years, everybody has fought this. My partner and my dad, they conspired against me, and they decided that they could do it.
Okay.
So I am in this now. We're doing this with this field. It's part of the operation now, and it's going to we're going to figure it out. I think we've done it.
Hey guys, we'll get to the podcast in just a minute. However, I am looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show, and I am planning a road trip across America and including parts of Canada. I'll tell you more about both of these at the end of this podcast. Howdy guys, today our guest is Rich Bradbury. Rich is co-owner of a ranch in Adel, Oregon. This is on the western side of the mountains and is pretty arid and dry. Rich has a range of experiences from working a number of different positions in the oil fields and a couple of different roles in ranching. He has even worked on a ranch in Russia. His skills over the years have come about by a significant amount of OJT, that is, on-the-job training. But the skill set is quite diverse and very technical. Additionally, Rich has dyslexia, and we will talk about that as well. Rich, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices show.
Thank you, John. Excited to be visiting with you. This is a great show you got going. I have to apologize. I didn't get to listen to all the episodes, but I listened to quite a few of them. And it was it's now in my podcast rotation.
Well, that's awesome. Thank you very much. And if you got any ideas to make it better, just shout at me. Well, Rich, we're going to get into your backstory, which is interesting. But give us a brief snapshot of the main projects and activities you are involved in today.
Well, today, the main project I'm involved in is I have a 1.5-year-old son. We're sort of rejiggering our life around making sure that being there for him as much as possible. So we've come back to Oregon out of the oil field and are focused on the ranch primarily. And it's going really well. I partnered with a guy, I have a partner on a ranch in Adel about 3 or 4 years ago, and we have seen tremendous growth. We're working on regenerative type of approaches to our fields in Adel and the cattle, and we've taken up a lot of leases in the area around where we run cattle. So a lease, for those that don't run cattle, is where you rent somebody else's land so that you can have a place for those cattle to be. So we've taken an operation that can comfortably run 250 head, and now we're running close to 600 head of our own cattle, plus another 200 to 300 outside cattle, which is people that we run cattle for and manage for them so that during the year, so they're also probably looking for land. Beyond that, I'm going to do a little bit of substitute teaching, and I'm currently working on getting my real estate license, and I hope to focus on buying and selling ranch properties eventually. That's what I'm working on right now.
And one of the things that I heard you say is that you're doing regenerative.
Yeah, I have a little bit different background than most ranchers. My parents started a natural beef company that sells primarily in the San Francisco, Seattle, Portland regions of the United States. It's natural, antibiotic-free, hormone-free. We're working on a grass-fed project that will stay in the same markets. So since the 1980s, I have not lived the life of a typical, I was not raised in the life of a typical rancher. I would say that my parents were very progressive, and sort of because of that, I have a different perspective than a lot of ranchers. So I never questioned when I started out to take on an operation of my own and be responsible for it, that that operation would do anything more than be regenerative type of project and sustainable. The thing about sustainability, when you talk about sustainable, is it's just good enough. When you talk about regenerative, it's something that you can build on and will provide more. It's something that you can add on to. So that's why I think the shift from sustainable has moved to the word regenerative, because we're really looking at increasing our outputs, making better habitat for wildlife, making better soil systems. So we think, and there's a lot of people that throw this words around lightly, but we think that by practicing regenerative agriculture, grazing, the way that we approach the management of our soils, we're actually building something that will have a greater market value and therefore take better care of us in a monetary fashion. There's the altruistic regenerative, and then there's the dollars and cents regenerative, and they can both coexist.
Right.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you're leasing land. Your principals was actually improving their property value as well, because as you do this, there's going to be a higher yield. And so even though you're paying to be there, they're actually winning in a sort of way.
Oh, yeah. And the guys that we lease land from, they sort of, part of our goal with the Double Orlock Ranch was that we would take on different properties. And so this is our first big scale year, but we're already doing improvements to the leases that we take on. So we do sort of a trade-off. We pay them, but if we see an improvement on their land that needs to be done, I'm not shy about going to that guy and saying, hey, I'm going to put this money into this fence here so that we can control the grazing so we can rotate better. And you're going to knock a couple $1,000s off of my bill. I'll get that brace in and make sure that that's done well. And usually they're all for it because it's increasing the value of their land. So we're just not going into these leases and taking. We're going in and trying to improve them. And we have good partners in the people that are leasing to us, that they allow us and see the value of letting us try and make their place better, just like we would do. We'd make our own resources better.
In your example, you gave, like, you're going to put in a brace or something on the fence. Hypothetically, if they knocked off $2,000, would that be something that if they paid somebody to come in, it would cost more than that, but you're actually doing it for less just because you're there? You just want to kind of cover some of the cost of the materials and it's a win-win, or how does that break down?
Exactly. So I'm not saying I'm doing it for free, but I'm doing it for way under market value.
It's beneficial to both of you.
Yeah, cost plus 10% probably, which the fencing, the guys that do the fencing now that you're talking about, I had a guy quote me a fence price at $25,000 a mile.
Wow. Just regular fencing?
Just regular fencing, six wire, barbed wire, and the braces. Yeah. I have a guy that helps me out and we just go and knock it out. So, I mean, it costs me a couple afternoons during the week and some material costs. And what it provides back to me and control the animals and being able to utilize the resource better. Also, it's a mutually beneficial thing. And then they'll have it in the future. If we're not their lessees, at least we left that place better than when we got there.
Right. If you have a fence that is a mile long, along the way, do you have to put in more significant posts and cross bracing? And if so, how far apart are those?
It really depends on the terrain and the type of situation. Our cattle mostly respect fences, and especially since we've been using electric fence more, they don't pressure as much. Some places you can get by with three or four wires, and some places you need six. Just depends on what application you're trying to use, the terrain, and what's on the other side of the fence, because that's really what the draw is, to put pressure on the fence is what the animal sees on the other side of the fence that might be worth testing that fence.
Okay. And outside of the strands, the number of strands, I've seen fencing that you're just driving along the road and then they'll have a heavy post and then about, I don't know, maybe 8 to 10 feet, they have another heavy post and then they have some cross bracing in between. And then you just keep on driving and then later along the road, there'll be another similar situation. What are those used for?
Oh, so the braces?
Right.
They're the anchor points. So you need two good anchor points to stretch the wire. And then you can put steel posts, the T-posts, in between for pretty sizable distance. And then sometimes if you just put a brace in the middle of the two main braces, that can strengthen up the fence. So we like to build good strong braces at the corners and the edges. And then being in the Great Basin, fencing is not really a high priority, but it's important.
Okay.
There are some people that go way overboard on their fences, and all the power to them. But yeah, we like to keep the fences up enough to keep the cattle where they need to be and not have to really worry about doing the maintenance. Everybody goes around their fences every year pretty much in the little community that I live in. So what is that saying? Good fences make good neighbors.
Indeed, so much. Using the regenerative approach, I can speculate that you do not allow herbicides on your ranch.
Now, this is the interesting thing. So I think in the United States, we have this perspective of this pristine agriculture landscape, this cute farm, red barn, and white picket fences, and that kind of stuff. But really, and it's a beautiful notion, but we are onset by a siege of invasive species and weeds.
When you say invasive species, are you talking about a species that is, A, it's not normally from this area and it's coming in, or B, there's an imbalance somehow that has allowed a native species to grow out of control?
A little bit of both, mostly the outside weeds that we see. I think if it's a native species, if it's supposed to be there and you have the right water ratios and that and so forth, then that doesn't get out of balance because it's used to competing with the species of plants around it. What happens when you have an out of the area species is it comes and it crowds all that diversity of the native plants out. And a lot of times it just starts to eradicate everything around and it becomes the primary species. And to have a really healthy ecosystem, you have to have a diversity of species. And if one plant is hogging all the resources, then you are not going to have that and your soil is just going to degrade. So ideally, to have a good, healthy ecosystem on a pasture or a rangeland or a ranch land, you want to have at least 12 distinct grasses and forbs have that diversity so you can get that organic nitrogen cycle that you want to look for. So you don't have to put the fertilizers and everything back onto that field. Just with you get that natural fertilization from the animals being on it, just from the decay of the plants that are there already. So when you're dealing with a species that comes in and wipes out all that diversity, then you have problems. So you have to address that. On the scale of the landscapes that we operate on, you can't have a guy out there with a hoe hoeing out all those species. That it would be like the monkeys typing the novel. It's just not possible there's just not that much manpower in the West to do what it would take to get the invasive species out. So yeah, we target and use chemicals to kill weeds.
300 years ago, would you have seen that range of different grasses? You say, we're just going to go with an approximate 12 grasses. What was the mix back in its natural state before we actually came to this country and really started changing things?
Oh, there is a great book by a man named Dan Flores called The American Serengeti. And he begins to start piecing together what that ecosystem looked like. And I'm not going to say that I'm not going to be one of those ranchers that pans on the table and says, oh, I'm sustainable, but never does the practice of it. Our education in the agriculture industry has increased exponentially every year. So if you're trying to put the values of somebody that was ranching in my area 150 years ago onto me, that would be inaccurate because those guys didn't understand all their cause and effect actions. They were doing the best they could, but they wiped out a lot of the species along the way.
Right.
I think over time, we'll start seeing the species come back because we have a better education and a better understanding of where we want to go and what really makes healthy soil. There's always this battle between science and conservation and resource management. And it tips back and forth all the time. And I think that finding that balance is always the trick. We lean more towards the conservation side, but you can't really fault people that need to be profitable that lean more towards the science side. We want to keep that science good, but want to move more towards conservation so that's better for society as a whole.
Well, those are all absolutely good points. You know, the Dust Bowl was all due to poor farming techniques, exposing the soil, drying everything out. We had weather conditions that contributed, but if we still had the 6 and 8 foot tall grasses growing, that would have never been an issue regardless of how dry that summer was. The land that you're in now, before ranchers and farmers even got on that land. And if we want to go back even further, 500, 1,000 years ago, that's kind of where I was curious about what the makeup would be of the different grasses at that point in time.
Given the elevation where I'm at, it'd be really tough to say, but I would say that there was more. Right now, it's the Great in the Great Basin, there's a huge Great Basin sage, big plains of Great Basin sage. And what the interesting thing about that is people think, oh, no, there's no grass out there, but there's a tremendous amount. There's a whole nother level of plants that grow underneath that sage. And that's what our cattle graze on, is the grass that grows underneath that sage and is protected. I'd imagine there was a lot more grass species, probably a lot more edible forb species. And a lot of the rangelands that we graze on very well could not have, might not have changed for eons. So I look at some of the grasses out there. I think this is like, when you talk about grass fed, this is this is an ancient grass that's been surviving on this desert plain for millennia.
It's ideally adapted.
Yeah. You can go into the pasture. That's relatively new grass. Even if it was planted, if it's been planted in the last 10 or 20 years, it's very young. But you go out into these rangelands in the United States, like in the prairies, who knows how long those grasses have been there, way before humans were ever here, probably. Part of the thing is the species have changed. The animal species have changed dramatically. So there used to be buffalo in my part of the world, which I'm fascinated by. So there used to be this push in Oregon and there is actual big chunks of land around where we have where our cattle go onto federal permits that are, they don't graze. I think that having a cloven hoof animal like a buffalo or a cow is very much part of how this, my part of the area, has developed. And while cattle aren't as romantic as buffalo, they're still serving the part to the ecosystem as that tool.
Right.
So, and if something needs to fill the void for the predator or the prey and the grass, I mean, what is it that I've heard? Nature abhors a vacuum. It's going to fill it one way or the other. So luckily with the cattle, we filled it in such a way that it's beneficial to more people than just having an animal that's never cultivated and doesn't advance human civilization along. Is that too deep?
No, we can go deep, 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 deep. And everybody can just follow along at their best ability. What is a typical day like on your ranch? That's a wide, diverse range, but just kind of give us an idea.
Well, we only have two seasons. We have, we have four seasons, but we have the time when the cattle are in the valley, and then we have the time when the cattle are either out on rangelands or out in the different leases that we have. When they're in the valley, we try and have enough residual feed. So currently our operation hays during the summer in the meadows and the pastures in the valley where the water is the greatest. And then we stockpile that feed for the cattle during the winter. We have slowly begun to, we'll probably always hay a little bit, but we've slowly begun to manage the way that we hay. So we hay earlier. And then we allow those pastures to grow back up. So when those cattle come back this time of year, they're coming onto pastures that still have, and some of them, I was out doing soil samples yesterday, and in some of those pastures, a couple days ago actually, some of those pastures, we got anywhere between 8 to 12 inches of regrowth. So we're decreasing the amount of time that we are having to feed the cattle during the winter and extending the time that they're just in pastures grazing, doing what cows do. So ideally, and my dad's been able to accomplish this, he has an operation in Nevada where they don't feed any, they don't hay or feed any hay. They're always either on pasture lands or on range lands year round. And that is a very low input operation. That's the healthiest way for things to go about, the easiest on the people and on the animals. But right now we're sort of getting in the mode to get all the cows back to Adel, and, we'll start to do the vaccinations and wean the calves from the mothers. And those calves will go on to California or into Idaho and be on pastures and go into their next transition of their life. The mother cattle will be here in Oregon and we'll focus on them.
the cattle that you're shipping off, is that still your properties?
We have a couple different markets. Like I said, we're developing the grass-fed market, so those cattle will probably go to California, and I will sell those cattle to my, it's sort of incestuous, but I'll sell that to my father, and he has the cash resources to get those to the final marketplace, which is going to be another 16 months from now. We just don't have the cash flow to keep that animal. The cattle, it'll go to the natural beef company that was started back in the 80s. I'll retain ownership of those. The calves that are getting weaned are 9 to 10 months. They'll get harvested at 18 months. So I'll retain ownership of those until they get sold at the Whole Foods in Seattle or San Francisco.
Okay. Sounds tasty.
Oh, the natural beef that we sell is very tasty. The grass-fed is make your eyes roll back. It's we really hit a home run with that one.
Well, the demand for grass-fed beef is definitely increasing.
Well, the interesting thing about the grass-fed one that we're in, we found a base breed that is perfectly suited for grass-fed. What we found is a Wagyu variant called an Akiyushi, which was raised on an island in Japan. It's a composite breed between an Akiyushi, a Simmental, which is a European breed, and a Devon, which is also a European breed. And those cattle were isolated on a Japanese island since the 20s, 1920s.
Okay.
And if you know anything about the Japanese, they're meticulous about how they go about breeding and
Kaizen.
Yes. And so until some doctors from Texas came and found them and managed to sneak 3 or 4 of them out of the country, they had been perfectly controlled in Japan on an island, completely isolated. They convert grass amazingly, and they have that beautiful Wagyu marbling. And then we crossbreed them with our desert cattle, and man, it makes for a great combination.
That sounds really good.
Yeah, we're very fortunate that we were favored in such a way to find that breed. If people are interested, there's a company out of Texas that sells them, and it's called Heartbrand. And then our grass-fed operation is called Desert Mound Beef, which we're pretty small and not in many markets yet, but check it out.
Well, I'll definitely put that in the show notes.
Sorry for the plug.
Oh, dude, absolutely plug. I want to promote as much as possible. So I'll definitely put that in the show notes. And of course, all the other items and things that are relevant to do whatever I can to help promote your growth and what you're doing. I was curious about the vaccinations. How spread out is that? Do you have all of the breeding and everything taking place so that it kind of gets clumped together? Maybe you have an intensive couple of weeks that you're actually doing this particular functionality.
Yeah. So we could do a vaccination on the cows once a year, and then we do a vaccination on the calves twice. Shortly after they're born, they get vaccinated, and then before we send them on to California or to Idaho, they'll get vaccinated again. And that should do them for the rest of the remainder of their time. If you're lucky enough to become a cow in the cow cough operation, you get it once a year. Really, there's not much better than be one of my cows. You get to live a long time. You get well taken care of. You're always fed. You always got water. It's a great life.
That's great.
Yeah. And we love them. So it's a, there's a lot of guys that do a lot of things, but we focus primarily on cow cough operations. So
how do you track each cow? I mean, how do you identify it? How do you keep track so that you know exactly what's happened with each one?
That's another misconception is we're a very small percentage of the producers in the United States. So I don't remember the breakdown, but let me see if I get this right. Of all the producers in the United States, the average producer produces 45 head of cattle. They have 45 mother cows on their operation. That's 80% of all producers. So when you break down where we're at amongst producers, we're in the top 4% as far as size. And we're getting up into an area where we just cannot afford to do the record keeping that you can do if you have 45 head. So we sort of manage in holes. And I've tried to find different types of software, but the economics just aren't there. When you're talking about spending $40 a head on tracking system, you're talking about 1 month's worth of feed for that animal. And then so you pay $45 so you can track that animal. Then you pay another $45 to replace that $45 that you fed. So you're into $80 in a business that has very low margins. So the fact that we can't track them doesn't mean that they're not healthy.
Right.
It just means that they're just animals, just like they just don't get tracked.
So you don't tag them or anything like that?
Oh, we tag them. So like if we need to sort one out, we could say, oh, go get this one. But
okay. So when I talked about tracking, it would be more like, say you just have an Excel spreadsheet, you got the tag numbers in there.
Yeah, we sort of work on the Octum razor, the simplest solutions, the best solutions. I have a rant about ag technology. It's not cost effective. Unless you're running a dairy of like 100 head or you've got a 45 herd head and you can afford, it's a recreational hobby type thing. So you have all this money going into ag tech, and then the producers that need it can't afford to do it. It just wipes out the economy of scale for them. But
so let me ask you this. I know I'm interrupting.
Yeah.
But if the software was free, would it be beneficial?
See, I'm not looking for free.
Well, I understand. But what I'm trying to get to is, if the software was free, would you see a benefit from being able to track it? Because there has to be a value to even use it before you even discuss how much you'd actually pay for something. So I was just curious if, you know, if that would help optimize and improve things, just having the ability to track it without there actually being an associated expense in the software, because I know it's going to take time to actually plug the data in and pull reports and that type of thing.
Yeah, that's the thing. See, so it could be free and it still wouldn't be useful, because unless I can put it on my phone, and let's say it's not me, it's one of my guys that goes and works on and is with the cattle every day. Unless he can put it on a phone and he can take that phone and he can ride on a horse, and as that animal, say, gets sick and he has to doctor it, he can then enter that information into that phone and it can go somewhere from that phone to me. It does me no good. Or like when they're tagging the calves when they're first born, I don't tag every one of my calves, so I can't do the data entry. So if the person that I pay to go around and tag calves every morning when I'm off doing something with another group of cattle, if she can't take and put that information immediately into the phone, it's not going to get done, because she's got four other things that she has to do that's more critical than entering that calf's data. She's got to make sure they're tagged right. She's got to match them up with their mother. She has to catch them in a low-stress manner. She's got to make sure they're not sick. She's got to get them up and going. And then to add on top of that, she's got to get the tagging system and get that, do the data entry part of it. And as much as we can hope that that's something she's going to do, that's the first thing that she's going to not do, because it's the least critical thing to that animal at that time.
Okay.
So that technology has to be able to be rugged, and it's got to be practical. And what happens is these technologies get made in a vacuum. They think, well, this will be great because here's the outcome in the end. But they never put the thought into the economics of it. Well, I think they think they put the thought into the economics of it, and they never put the thought into, is this practical or not? Is this something that people will actually use? And when you come right down to it, when you're operating in all sorts of different conditions, you have to have something that's robust and reliable and simple and fast. And ag technology, as much as it's heralded, is just not there. And I harp on it all the time, because I have salesmen always coming to me and saying, oh, I got this wonderful, this is the next best thing, this is going to change your whole operation. And I'm like, no, man, you haven't put the time in to think about how it's going to work. Can my hand use it, or can I use it readily? And it's just not there. So that's the end of my rant.
It's all good. Well, and I'll edit this and cut it up a little bit, but it's good. It's good to have that viewpoint, and I'm happy that you did it. Your commentary reminds me of a joke I heard. There is this old grizzled farmer, and he was approached by a guy that was fresh out of college, and he's talking to the farmer, and he's like, look, I can provide you information that can help you increase your yields on your fields by 3 times. And the farmer's like, I already know how to increase my yield by 3 times.
Yeah.
And the joke being that the farmer knew how to increase his yield, but if he did so, there's all these other factors that come into place. It's not just about increasing the yield. There's a lot of variables that go into that. And so you have to look at the full picture is all I'm getting at.
I have had this harped into me from my my parents are brilliant people, and they have a very holistic approach to everything they do. And I think that bleeds out into their children. And that's why sometimes when we talk about all the little pieces and the whole altogether, we sound a little bit radical.
Well, nothing wrong with being radical. So you talked about your typical day, and we talked a little bit about some of that, but if you kind of look at pick a couple of experiences over the last couple of weeks that would illustrate different things that you do. It's not the same every day. Just kind of just gives people an idea of some of the different things that would happen.
I'm going to go forward first. So, I know what I did last week. So we shipped some cattle out of California. And when I say ship, that means we loaded them on trucks and sent them to California and to Boardman, Washington. And the ones in Boardman, Washington, they're sort of in the final phase of becoming dinner. And the ones that are going to California are still, they're part of the grass-fed program. So they're sort of in that second phase of putting on the weight they'll need to become hamburger also. But it's such a much longer timeline. So my brother-in-law came from California where they're going to go. And then myself and my dad and my sister and one of our cowboys went down, and we brought them all in. We vaccinated them and preg tested them and split them for the cattle, the ones that were going to keep as cattle and the ones that are going to go on as feeders. And that took probably 3 whole days of pretty intense work. And then at the end, we actually put them on a truck and moved them to another pasture, and they'll be there for the next 90 to 120 days. We won't vaccinate them again, but we'll have the whole process of gathering them, sort of sorting them, make sure we made all the right decisions, and then they'll go on to the next stage in getting to become somebody's dinner or be on the market shelf.
And that's the third phase?
I don't know. I'm just making up phases as I go, but trying to break it down so that it's understandable.
Sure. Well, when they go to Washington, what happens there? What is the purpose of their trip to Washington?
Okay, so over the years, we've been trying to get away from conventional feeding, like the big factory plants. That's not 100% possible, and to still be economically viable as an operation, we still do that a little bit. We're desperately trying to transition completely into this grass-fed thing, so our cattle will never see feedlots, but it's a long system to set up. After 3 years, we're getting more and more resources to be able to support that grass-fed animal. But right now, when they go to Boardman, they're going to go up and they're going to be in a feedlot. And it's a unique type of feedlot, but it's still a feedlot. And they're going to be there for the next 90 to 120 days. And those cattle will be grass-fed, but they're still a natural antibiotic-free cattle. They're still healthier than what you're going to get out of a conventional feedlot. And what they do at that feedlot is so that they're not in the pens all day. And the worst thing that everybody imagines is that pen lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sympathetic to it also, but economics just don't transition as fast as the public wants it to transition. I mean, we're working on it, but we still have to be economically viable. So what we've done in that situation in that particular group is those cattle get out of that pen and they have an hour to 45 minutes. And some of them are raised in what they call pasture lots. So they get fed, but then they have this huge pasture they can go mow around on and be cattle. But not all of them are. And then the ones that can't are in the traditional type of feedlot that you think, they get moved out of there. They get released into this big pasture for a certain part of the day so that they don't have to stand in there. They can stretch their legs out. It's on a pasture setting, and then they go back in to the feedlot where they get fed. Like I said, we're trying to transition to the point where we don't have to even worry about that feedlot process anymore.
Well, I definitely wish you success on eliminating that particular step.
Yeah. There's a lot of people to feed out there, and there's just not much land resources to do it. And the economic system is not in the United States. It's not set, the ag financing in the United States is not set up to facilitate that transition that the customer is asking for. It's a slow process. We're going slow to go fast. When you deal in agriculture, you don't deal in months, you deal in years. And so,
right.
Yeah, it's a very slow process. Everything you do, and just the nature of the beast, I guess.
Well, I understand. So you have a number of different ranches, and you have yours that's in Adel. you have a number of locations that you are working together with, but how did you choose Adel as a location for your ranch?
This is a long, convoluted story. When I was a kid, my grandfather originally started in sheep, and in the 70s, he transitioned to cattle. And my parents got married in the 70s, and they came back to the ranch that my grandfather started. And there was a bunch of kids that lived on it, and it was sort of the tragedy of the commons. So as more families moved in, the resource got more and more scarce, and everybody was trying to get ahead. Towards the middle of the 80s, there was a lot of infighting, and everybody's going along.
Never good.
Yeah, but it's part of ranch life, and it's just something that happens, and you can hide it, but it doesn't just happen to my family, it happens to all families. So the infighting just got worse and snowballed. So we had this little operation that we were running on the corner of this resource that had all these other families on it, and when push came to shove, we're the ones that got shoved off. And it was bad timing. In desperation, my parents, they bailed out to northern Nevada, got all the cattle to this lease. And this was back in the early 2000s. We were entrenched in this one place in Oregon for all these years. We got just booted out and had to go to this place we'd never been to try and survive and take the cattle there, and just changed our whole paradigm of what our expectations were. It was a blessing, because from there we were able to my parents were able to build on that. They did a great thing. They tried to set up something for each of their kids so that they could go on ranching if they wanted. And so my middle sister, she took on the operation in Nevada. And then there was an opportunity that presented itself in the Bay Area to have another lease. It's around Livermore, the Contra Costa area. So we sort of went in there. We made a bid on the lease. We added a really significant environmental component to it, because we were never going to be able to compete on the price, but we could bring a certain level of environmental expertise from a partner that we had met in Nevada. And so he went down with us. He does rangeland evaluation and really technical stuff using satellites, radio spectrum imaging, that kind of stuff. So we brought a whole new environmental component to this lease that we have now in California. So we rewarded that lease, and that became part of our operation. And my youngest sister and her husband moved on and are managing the day-to-day operations on that lease. As our enterprises grew, the cattle that they were packing along for me sort of became it sort of got to the point where they couldn't grow and keep my cattle. So we did have a little toehold still left in Oregon around where the original ranch was. And so my cattle got shipped back up here to Oregon, and I was in the oil field at the time, and I made a deal with a good friend of mine that we decided that we were going to partner. I bought cattle from him in the past. He'd worked for me before when we were still in Oregon, and he'd rebuilt his cattle herd since the last time I bought it. I said, hey, I can't be here. I'm not in a financial position where I can be there every day to manage these cattle, but they're going to be there. They have to be there. So I'll partner with you. He agreed. We started with 90 head, and he brought almost 30 head to the thing. So altogether, we had about 120 head when we started, and that was 2015. And now we're up to about just a little under 500 head. What we learned when we got kicked off the ranch, the original ranch, is that you can't stay stagnant. You have to go out and look for more places for those cattle to be. And that's why we've expanded. And that's why I was talking about the partnerships that we have with the people that we lease from and taking care of their resource. And for us to grow, we can't just rely on that one little single resource in Adel. We have to grow as this is a long shot, but I'm looking at a place right now in South Dakota where I'll just send 200 head and they might just live there the rest of their lives. And then, so I'll have an operation in California in Oregon and bouncing back to, between there and South Dakota. But it's just part of it's a year round lease, and it's very intriguing. It's 3,300 acres of prairie grassland that they'll be out on all the time. So there's always opportunities coming up. Most ranchers aren't going to pick up and move to South Dakota, but over the last 20 years, we've learned that you have to be very flexible to survive in the ranching game, survive and thrive.
If you put the cattle up there, would you have to provide like a barn or some type of shelters? How do you do that?
Well, normally when you lease a ranch, especially on a year-round ranch, you get the housing, you get the facilities, everything. There's very few leases that you walk into that doesn't have a set of corrals, doesn't have some sort of outstructures, and doesn't have one or two houses. When you lease that ranch, you come in and you get use of all those facilities and infrastructure.
I'm thinking about if there's weather issues, like you have a storm coming in and you have the cattle up there, do you have to have somebody go up there and manage those cattle and move them around, or can they go into shelter that you've already built? Do they just go under? How does all that work?
No, there'd have to be somebody up there. And so what the deal is, my strategy for survival is I built up enough of a critical mass of cattle that like I would do something similar, probably my partner and I now, because we're 50-50 on it. We would do something similar that I did with him. We'd say, hey, look here, we're going to provide you 250 head of cattle. You'll watch them. We'll pay you so much a month for each head of cattle. You can add your own cattle into this mix, but you're in charge of this operation. You're responsible for everything that happens. And then I go in and I help with the strategic planning, getting the financing. Really, that's a lot of what I do, is keeping money in front of everybody so that they can keep managing and doing what they do best. My partner is excellent at operations. The highest purpose I can use is to keep him going, to be his support system and keep him happy and keep him feeling like he's fulfilling the role that he's supposed to fulfill. And that's what we'd look at in this operation in South Dakota. We try and find somebody that wanted to grow, and then we provide that platform and provide the resources to help them start going, and hopefully it would turn into a partnership that would be long-term.
In such a partnership with the person that would be managing those 250 cattle, would that require day in and day out, or would they still have the option to, for instance, take a part-time job and do both?
No, that's the beauty part about it. I work other jobs, but the guys that my partner, he has another job, but when we hire somebody, that's what they do. They do, or we partner, then we provide that so that they don't have to do that and they can just focus 100% on the cattle.
Okay.
Now, if it's a husband wife team, one of them might have to work, but it would be one person job full time, just focused on the cattle. And that's ideal for us because that's what our business is. So,
but a bachelor rancher / cowboy, he'd be in heaven.
Yes, that would be the ultimate deal.
I noticed the other day a post on LinkedIn about taking soil samples, specifically regarding Field 55. You mentioned doing a lot of crunching of the numbers. How deep can you get into the numbers, and how much difference does it make? Meaning you can make rough assessments and make changes, pH, etc. What all are you measuring, and how are you making changes based on these numbers? Feel free to get deep into the science, even if it is more than I might understand.
I'm not much into the science. I have a basic grasp on it. And this is an experiment so I can get more into the science, but I am into the numbers. There's not very often that in the West that as a rancher that you can go out and buy a piece of property. And I'm not going to say I bought this piece of property. My parents bought this piece of property. We had a long conversation about it. I did not want to get this field because it had a huge 180 acre dead spot right in the middle of it.
Wow.
And for the last 20 years, everybody has fought this. My partner and my dad, they conspired against me, and they decided that they could do it.
Okay.
So I am in this now. We're doing this with this field. It's part of the operation now, and it's going to, we're going to figure it out. I think we've done it. A lot of our resources went into transforming this field. So we changed a significant part of the infrastructure so that we can drain it.
Okay.
And we've started to see an increase in what it will produce per acre. So that got me thinking, now that we have these four large fields in Adel, each have good qualities and some of them have bad qualities. So I'm trying to drill down why one will produce more tons of hay per acre than the other one. And some of it has to do with water. The reason I'm looking at this from such a high level is because I want this Field 55 to be on average with the rest of the fields. But what I'm doing is I'm pushing the value of each acre, what each acre of each field will produce. And there's a discrepancy on them all. The soil sample is to see what is going on underneath the ground in each field so that we can see why one field is doing better than the other. And then what we have to do to get that field 55 so that it functions like the rest of the ecosystem around it. And it starts producing more dollars per acre like the rest of the fields. Are you following me on what I'm trying to do?
Absolutely.
Okay. So I'm using the dollars per acre as a metric, but I think that what I'm seeing, and this is good, I think that this will prove out over the end, is the more that that acreage is producing, is the healthier it is.
Mm-hmm.
And the more habitat it's providing, and the more it's just providing a more diverse ecosystem within the valley. So to understand the value per acre is going to lead me to, with Field 55 and some of our other fields, to increase that diversity, that health, the healthy soil, those kind of metrics. And now, the more that I've been looking at the numbers, some of the fields that we're haying, that might not be the highest and greatest use of them. That might not be looking out after the best interest of that piece of land, that resource, and maybe running cattle on them in the summer rather than haying them is going to be more effective for us as an operation, better for the cattle, and better for that resource. That's the deep dive that I'm doing into the individual fields. And what I'm trying to do is, once I figure out all the formulas and the ratios, it's never going to be the same for every field. But if I can find out some ways of measuring the monetary value with the health value, then I can go in and look at other resources, some of our lease resources, and see what the best use for them is so that they can be the most healthy ecosystems as possible, and what's the best tools to get them to that point. And I wish I could verbalize it better, but I see where I'm going, but I haven't built the whole structure as how to do it. I'm pretty confident I'm almost there. And then once I understand that, that challenge of not being able to purchase more ranch lands, because the cattle enterprise will not support what it costs to buy raw land or raw ranch land in the United States right now. So growth is limited to leases. Hardly ever are you going to buy a ranch unless you sell a ranch and buy a bigger place. But if I can understand what the actual economics of it is, I can find those pieces of property out there that I can run my cattle on that I can afford to pay for. And I can show that metric to a bank or to somebody that's going to finance me or an investor. And I said, look, this is what I've seen on fields that we've worked on. These are the tools I can bring to bear, and this is where I can get you. And I think that
you're changing the equation.
I think that there are, I think that there are properties out there that are affordable. You just can't look at it in the traditional way. You have to be able to look at that soil. You have to know what's going on underneath. And you have to be able to step back from your paradigms and say, look, this has been a hay meadow for the last 80 years. That is not the highest function of this field. It might be that you get 4 months of feed out of it by haying it, but if you ran cattle on it for 3 months, then it might actually pay more. So you can just by running the cattle on it and grazing it and never using any, never haying it, using any mechanical instruments on it at all, you might be able to create a higher value per acre on that field than what people traditionally thought was the best use of that.
Is there any value to conceptualizing here, grazing for 5 years, then haying for one, grazing for another number of years, and rotating things around? Does that have any impact?
You know, I'm not there yet. That would be an interesting thought experiment also. So I do play around a lot. It's very hard when you're trying to meet a bottom line. It's the one thing that the ecologists and people that are in land management are always preaching is that you should rest acreage entirely. And that's very tough to do when you have to pay bills and pay the bank and that kind of stuff.
Sure.
So you try and...
And testing is expensive.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like if you make the wrong move and you've decreased production, it's like, well, that test didn't work and I learned, but now I'm down, I'm making these numbers up, you know, $14,000 on this field.
Yeah. And I think that people that are not in agriculture need to realize that it doesn't matter if you're doing organic or what type of agriculture you're doing, just on what the razor's edge that people in agriculture live on. It's like all entrepreneurship. You don't know if you're going to be around the next year. You can't make too many bad decisions. They all have to be, they all have to have cash flow. They all have to have, they all have to be on sound judgment. And sometimes the resource suffers for that. Mm-hmm. And it's because we don't recognize that in the United States, there's this perception that everything's nice and rosy on farm and ranches, but that's an industry that's suffering, and it's the lowest median income industry in the United States right now. And you can't expect good results out of a system that you aren't willing to compensate people to be in.
Right.
It's an interesting dynamic. I'd like to flip that narrative. And that's sort of what my passion is right now. All capital comes from land, and there's no bigger, more valuable land in the United States than the farm and ranch lands that are in private hands right now. We're holding back urban sprawl, rural sprawl. We are holding back some of the most, we're protecting some of the most pristine landscapes in the United States right now. And we're not doing it for nothing. We're doing it for the love of doing it and for the respect that we have for the land. And then you just get beat up all the time in the media and the ranching and farming industry. There's a guy in North Dakota or South Dakota, and he's got 3,000 acres of a monoculture. Well, it's better to be in a monoculture than it is to be in development or being mined or that kind of stuff. I don't want to have the monoculture there. I'd like to see him do more stuff, but he's still protecting a huge unalterated habitat for those animals. When he's not on there farming, there's a lot of stuff going on in that field. Now, could he have more stuff going on in that field? Yeah, a lot more if it's not a monoculture, but we just have to go a little bit at a time to change the way the change the narrative, change what people are doing. Okay, I'm done with that rant. So,
okay, well, the aspect of holding back the urban sprawl, the most prime farmland that has ever existed in this country, is pretty much subdivisions, malls, businesses covered by concrete and asphalt, because that's where we congregated, because that was the best farmland, and we grew from there. And as we grow out, we start expanding to the less and less desirable farmland, because ultimately we have to eat, we have to have cattle. So that's where people are, they're doing their thing, but that's where the populations form.
Yeah. And I've been working on this. I've worked with it on a group of called Thousand Friends of Oregon. And in my little community down here in Southeastern Oregon, is people move here that retire in large urban areas, and they have the money to buy 40 acres, 100 acres, and then they immediately build a house on it, and they break up the natural landscape because they want to have a little ranchette. Mm-hmm. And so they break up these huge, big, complex ecosystems so that they can put a house in the middle of it. And they break up the migration of the birds, and they make up the migration of the wildlife. Now, in these huge meadows that are so beautiful, and I don't care if you're grazing cattle on it or not, or sheep or goats or whatever, or if they don't get grazed at all, but there shouldn't be a house right in the middle of it. Houses should be built on places that aren't cultivatable. And not, when I say cultivatable, I mean usable by some sort of animal or to grow grass or some sort of wildlife. There's plenty of places on the, you don't have to build it right in the middle of the meadowlands and the floodplains and where the water is. You can build up on the sides of the hill where there's not as much of a impact. But people that retire have this paradigm in their head that they want to come and they want to have this 40, 50 acre little farm so they can have chickens, which I'm 100% for. You could do that on the side of the hill too. And, but they bring in their cats and they bring in their dogs and they screw up the migration of the birds. We need to have big, vast tracts of land. I advocate as a rancher that you can have that. You cannot disrupt flow of livestock and birds because cattle can coexist with those animals. You don't ever see a cow chasing a deer. I see birds living on my cattle all the time. They eat the flies out of their hair, which has been one of the wonderful mm-hmm. things I've seen come back into the ecosystem since we've outlawed some of the different type of chemicals. I forgot when I was a kid that birds used to sit on cattle's backs and eat them, and then they disappeared for a while, and now they're back, which is a good positive thing that we're making good steps forward. I'm passionate about preserving these large chunks of land, and cattle is one of the ways you can do it and still be productive. My goal is I'd like to get so established in ranching that I can come in when these little 40-acre or 80-acre places come up for sale. I want to get so established that I can come in and take bulldozer and return that back to native and take that structure completely out of there so that I don't have to look at it anymore. And it goes back into being productive for the whole of the area, for the whole of the region. And it's just not somebody's little end of life thing that they did for themselves.
That'd be significantly well healed to be able to make that happen.
Yeah. So anyways,
I understand the idea of wanting a little ranchette because hell, man, I'd want the same thing. And it's not so much that you're pointing at that it's the 40 acres, it's the location of the 40 acres.
Yeah. And like, I would love to work with people like on some of my lands that aren't as utilized for the cattle, not as critical to the operation, not as critical to the ecosystem. I would love to work with people. I'd love to work with regulators and say, here's 40 acres. Don't fence it in too much. Maybe you'll have a cow in your backyard occasionally when she's up getting some grass or something, or you might, and there's going to be deer, but don't overdevelop it. Put your house here, have your chickens, have some pigs and some sheep, or have your own cows, but just don't overdevelop it. Stay off of the most productive, the healthiest part of the ecosystem. Stop breaking it up. I'll facilitate that for you in this area. I just need to choose the area. You still have wonderful landscapes. You still have a wonderful view. Let's put a little reason and thinking in behind where we're putting our houses. Because there's a lot of great places on the margins where you can have a house and you can still have all the beauty that you want. And it doesn't disrupt the whole system very much.
Right. I was curious earlier, and I just wanted to step back to this for a second. When you're talking about doing the testing on Field 55, how deep do you go for your tests?
That was an interesting question. So the test only requires that you go 5 to 6 inches. They really just want to see what that topsoil is. And I think they must be able to gauge farther down below. My next step is I want to do some transects in my field. That's where you take an excavator or backhoe and you dig a deep pit so that you can see how deep down your roots are going.
Right.
And I have fields I know are going to be down to 7 to 6 feet. And then my Field 55, I'm worried it's going to be 6 to 7 to 8 maybe. And I could tell just doing the samples that the fields that I think have the healthiest roots systems, they are just mangled with roots.
Field 55, you've had for how long? Not necessarily you, but in the family.
3 years.
Okay.
Since then, we've put in two huge dike systems to drain the water out of it. Because what was happening in the 180 acres in the middle, it was just this dead, stale water. It didn't move around. It wasn't like a natural wetland type of situation.
Mm-hmm.
Because it would come and go. And what had happened is a parasitic grass had gone in there and pushed out all of the native grasses that could grow there. And so what we're slowly doing is we're bringing back the natural meadow fox, the meadow hays, the grasses that would traditionally be there and that are in all our other fields. What had happened with the parasitic grasses, it had formed a crust on the top of the soil and it wasn't allowing any other species to take hold. So in the winter, what we do is we go in and we feed the cattle there, and then their hooves break that up. And then we feed hay that's from the adjacent meadows. And so that seed and the action of the animal's hooves gets that seed in those places where that crust had developed.
Nice.
And you can see the meadow grasses slowly, sort of in a mosaic, coming back into that. So along the sides for about, I'd say about first 50 yards now, we're starting to see that meadow grass, that native grasses come back into that area because we have a better drainage system. We're going to improve the drainage system this next spring. And so it should be a fully functioning field here pretty soon. And I predict with the, I know this is weird, but we raise a lot of ducks, waterfowl.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the canals that run through the ranch, they provide a great shelter for the birds when they hatch. They can keep their babies in there until they're ready to fly and go on north. So by adding those two big dikes, when the cattails and the reeds and water type plants get in there, it's going to be providing a bunch of cover. And I'm really thinking about adding a bunch of trees into different parts of the fields so that we can even have more cover and more diversity so that those birds can get their chicks raised up and get them north and continue to see a good increase of birds. I sort of look at birds as a good gauge as to how I'm doing as a manager. If I can encourage more and more birds on my fields, that tells me I'm doing a great job.
Right. I pulled up your area on Google Maps and I was just looking at the terrain. It really looks pretty arid. Have you put in ponds?
No. When you're on the rangeland, there's springs that develop and they sort of naturally pool into ponds. Sometimes we built what they call a dirt tank where you just push up a levee on one side and it fills in. And if it overfills, then it goes on down the country. In the actual valley that we operate in was once a huge ranch. It was called the MC Ranch. They write songs about it and stuff. It's crazy.
Okay.
It's 260 miles of canals, and we own just a little small percent of it. And we're actually in a water district that we operate cooperatively in with the other ranchers that bought this huge ranch. And back in the 90s, 16 ranchers bought this ranch from George Gillette, who has the Gillette Razor Company.
Okay.
And we were bidding with it with the Nature Conservancy. And the Nature Conservancy, they knew it was important to preserve, and they had a paradigm of how they could preserve it. And as the ranchers in the area, they also felt that they could preserve it. So that it was contentious, but in the end, we ended up making a deal with the Nature Conservancy, and they thought, well, we were already enough guys that we could probably manage it and reach the same goals that they would have ultimately accomplished. So they stepped aside and they let the ranchers, the local ranchers, buy it. And man, it's been an exercise in cooperation. What was the big ranch and had all the people that you would normally think would normally a big corporation, big ranch would hire more people. But by splitting the ranch up into the different sections and different percentages, I think it's brought more people to the valley that are working, provided more jobs, definitely put more into the local economy as far as equipment, gas sales, and that kind of stuff. So it had a lot of marginal reactions that were unforeseeable back in the 90s when we were talking about it. And I think that each person managing a little part of it, actually the land gets better attention than when it's managed as a huge whole. Because each person has the self-interest to do the best that they can for their percentage of the what used to be the larger ranch. It's great. We got all sorts of kids going to school. It's our little community. You see, it's a type of community that it's fading in the West, and ours is thriving and growing because the opportunity's there to have more people living in the valley because there's just more jobs that we created by splitting it up. So my partner and I, we support about 1.5 people year round, and they live there and they contribute to the economy. And so it's a good feeling to be able to do that.
Being so remote, I was curious about the challenges of getting supplies, electricity, internet, et cetera. When I pulled up your city, it just seemed like really, really, really small. Is that kind of just a perspective issue? Do you live on your ranch, or do you live like in a house in the city, or how does all that work as far as all that supplies, electricity, internet, et cetera?
I live an hour away. Housing in our little community is difficult for people. So while I was gone, we rented our house to somebody that lives there and works in the valley. And so when I came back, I didn't want to run that person out. So I commute back and forth. My partner lives in the actual Adel Valley. I commute back and forth, and it works out all right this year because we have cattle in the little community that I live in now. I jump in the pickup. I'm 5 minutes from one herd of cattle and 10 minutes from the next herd of cattle. So I sort of take care of this side of the equation. When it comes to winter, I'll be commuting back and forth. What I said that we bought a bigger part of a bigger ranch. Well, those big ranches had bunk houses and cook houses and that kind of stuff. So one of our purchases here in the last couple of years for the double Orlock, our personal part of it is we bought the bunk house that used to house all the cowboys. Mm-hmm. And we're going to rebuild that into a place where people can stay and vacation. And we're going to make it into two apartments basically. And my plan is eventually I'll live in one part of that And we'll make a do an Airbnb thing so bird watchers can come and stay, and hunters, duck hunters. And
there you go.
Yeah. So
you'll bring a little extra income in as well.
Yeah. And it also helps us if we do add people, we'll have housing for them. So it's being so remote, that's one of the challenges is housing, especially as operations grow in our little community. And out of perspective, they think that the little community that I live in is the farthest community away from any interstate in the United States. Nobody's actually verified that, but there's been a lot of informal looks at maps and stuff. And we're as far away from an interstate. We're 90 miles from the closest McDonald's and Adele, we're 100 miles from the closest McDonald's and the closest Walmart.
That's a different perspective on running down and grabbing something.
One of the things I lamented, most of the time I love the lifestyle. As you can see, I get to hang out with my kid all the time. Got to take my dogs with me everywhere. It's a really great, it's lifestyle I think everybody would like. But this week I hear all this great stuff about the movie The Joker.
Mm-hmm.
It would take me 2.5 hours to drive somewhere where I could see it. So I'm just going to have to wait. It's just, that's one of the things. And like, we use Amazon like crazy, but we also try and support our local things. But these little communities in the West are, the economics has changed so much that it's harder and harder for the little small community stores and that kind of stuff to stay open. And I think like, we're technically in what they call a food desert. I don't know if you're aware of that.
I am.
You know you're in a food desert as soon as Dollar General moves in. And I find it ironic that where you produce some of the greatest food for the rest of America, that you can't even buy food, healthy food for yourself. So it's an interesting.
Well, Dollar General.
I'm not bitching about the Dollar General. Okay. They have a great.
All right. That's all good. I was just going to say Dollar General, although they do provide food products, they also provide a wide diversity of things, the little nitinoid things that you might need that is invaluable.
Yes. Yes. I should have classified that. I don't mean to be negative about Dollar General, but they do understand the demographics of where they're going to. There's strategy behind the way that they go about it, and they fill niches where other companies won't fill because there's just no margins there for them. I think it sort of tells the temperature of a regional economy when you see when the types of stores that are there move in. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I do.
Yeah.
My brother lives out in the country. He lives 5 miles from a grocery, small little grocery store south. They put in a Dollar General that's like 2 miles from their house on the way towards town, which is 16 miles away.
Uh-huh.
And so that's if you want to go to Walmart or whatever, that's a lesser distance than you'd have to travel. But there's many times they run to Dollar General just to get milk. You can get eggs. You can even get lunch meat. You can get, you know, a number of things that you might need all of a sudden.
Yes.
And it's way convenient. And that store does great business. They're right next to a little hardware store, a feed store, hardware store. It's a combination. It's such a rural community. If you want to go to Tractor Supply, that's, again, 15 miles away. And so the concept of the Dollar General has been, for them, they've really enjoyed it. I mean, I've even shopped there before when I was hanging out there for a while. So Dollar General, when they come in, yeah, they are cheap. And they are providing things. A lot of people aren't big fans of them. But the reason people go to Dollar General is they're providing something that people are looking for.
Right. Yeah. No, I shouldn't have been so negative. I apologize. But it's just an interesting change in the community that you see. It's a total swap of the economy just that I've seen in my lifetime.
Sure.
And I think it's happening in all rural America. So much of the resources are being, they don't get past those urban boundaries. I think it's sort of starving the rural areas. And it's at a time when the rural areas, the hinterlands that are providing these huge urban behemoths, they're the hinterlands are what's providing the lifeline to those urban areas. And it's an interesting dynamic because the median income in the rural areas is dropping. So it's providing less and less incentive for people to stay in those rural areas and produce that food and produce the resources that needs to go back to those urban economies. I don't know how we're going to change that trajectory, but it needs to change pretty quickly, in my opinion.
It is changing, and it's a catch-22. Part of that is the growth of the internet, which allows you to work from anywhere. You're going to start seeing a lot of people that are going to move to the cheaper areas because there's high-speed internet. They can work remote, but they're going to start impacting the rural area because they're going to bring in an attitude and a way of living that doesn't quite match the rural mindset.
Yeah.
And it's going to be a little bit frustrating on that side of things.
But I think the rural people also need to be open-minded. I think we're going to find a path forward, but it's going to be a tenuous time, I think.
Yeah. Let's take a little bit of a tangent. I'm curious. Do you ever hop on a horse to do your tasks?
I do. I don't do as much as I used to, but I joke with people that I already had, by the time I was in my late 20s, I had already had a full career. I did the whole cowboy thing. Yeah, I still get on a horse. I was thinking about it when I read that question that me and another guy in California are probably the only two people that are posting video content to LinkedIn horseback. I've done a couple videos riding my trusty horse, Bill, in the last few months. So I still enjoy riding horses. They still are the best tool in a lot of situations when you're dealing with cattle and when you have to work on ranch lands and range lands. And there is very much a horse culture in the community that I live in.
I can also see that the horse hooves are better for the land than riding on wheels.
After a while, an ATV will break down creek banks and stuff because you got to cross at different places. The horse, you have a lot more options as to how you can traverse the land. ATV limited, and so you start seeing paths, and it doesn't take that much out, but it definitely, ATVs definitely have a impact. And in a desert sort of arid situation like us, we live in a what would be considered a really fragile environment. So any damage that you do takes longer to recover from.
Are you the high desert?
Yeah. The other way they call it is the cold desert. So we get about 7 inches of rain a year. It's not uncommon to see 2 or 3 weeks of below 20 below weather. So,
and that's because of your neat geographical location.
We are. There's a phenomenon in the United States called the Great Basin, and it's the only place in the United States where the water doesn't run out to a sea. It actually runs into a place called the Carson Sink, just north of, runs into the Salt Lake area a little bit, and it runs into the Carson Sink, which is just north of Reno. So I'm on where the Great Basin transitions into the Cascade Mountain Range. So if I go east from here, all the water where I'm sitting right now, all the water runs to the Carson Sink or into the Great Basin. If I go 5 minutes west of here and go just up another 1,000 feet, all that water, every time a raindrop hits on that side, it's going to go to the Pacific Ocean.
Okay.
It's an interesting place. The Great Basin sort of has its own little subculture, just like you'd expect to find in the different parts of the region, I guess the Tennessee River Valley, that kind of stuff. But it's a real, what they call, there's a type of cowboy, a style cowboy that lives in the Great Basin called the Buckaroo. And they sort of, their tendency is a style of saddle. Now we're getting really deep into Western culture, but they have a special type of saddle that's called a slick fork that doesn't have the buck rolls that come down from the saddle horn. The saddle horns are normally a lot wider, and they wear a flat hat. So if you see a cowboy with a flat hat, you can pretty much guarantee that they're from the Great Basin. And the reason for that specific type of styling of the saddle and the hat is because it has a lot of Mexican influence. So in this part of the world, any cattle that were here 100, 200 years ago were most likely from Mexico, and they migrated up here and came back. So we hold on to a lot of those cultures here, a lot of that culture. The Mexican word for buckaroo is vaquero.
I've heard that.
Yeah. We're the northern vaqueros.
Okay. Do you get as much snow as they get in Klamath Falls?
We get less.
Okay. Because they get an awful lot there.
So they'd be on that west side of where the break is that I was talking about from the Great Basin to the Cascade. So all that water, once I drive out of here, that all goes into rivers that probably will eventually make their way through the Klamath Basin.
Okay. As we get close to the end here, one of the things that I wanted to cover is dyslexia. And you've been speaking about dyslexia. Tell us why and what your goals are on this topic.
Dyslexia is sort of an interesting thing. I was probably one of the very early people that just when they started figuring it out was diagnosed with it. And some of the stuff they did on me was the early experimental stuff as to how to manage being dyslexic. It was a tough time because there was a mindset that it was a problem that needed to be cured. After I learned how to read, I didn't learn how to read until I was in seventh grade. After I learned how to read and I started getting strategies to deal with having a learning disability, I found that it was also really beneficial because it allowed me to have a different perspective and pull different information from my brain's just wired to pick up and organize information differently. And I'm also adept with workarounds. The world makes you want to conform to a certain type of education to that. And so as a dyslexic, because that is difficult, you have to always adapt and work around so that you can fit in that channel that all your peers are in. So that makes you extremely flexible. Plus you have this, just the way the brain's wired, is you're able to gather information and pull it together more. But you also have all the limiting things like writing. I still will occasionally mix up my B's and my D's, P's and Q's are just, you never know when it's going to show up. So I don't write. I mostly type everything. I use a word processing program called Grammarly, which I think you use also.
Absolutely.
Yeah. It's an amazing tool for people with learning disabilities. I can't promote it enough. It totally changed the way that I am able to interact in the world.
It allows me to write things and people think I know how to spell.
Yeah.
Which I do, but it's amazing how much stuff it catches.
Oh yeah. And I cannot spell. Phonics eludes me. So it's always been a battle, but with my phone can spell better. I just ask my phone now and it spells for me. So provided I'm in a place where I have coverage, but if I'm not in a place where I'm and have cell phone coverage, I probably don't need to be spelling that much anyways, probably doing cow work. But there's been this great movement, and this is by the time this gets on the air, it probably won't, but it is Dyslexic Awareness Month, October, and Richard Branson is one of the poster children of dyslexia, and he's put together a really great campaign called Made by Dyslexia. There's a lot of people thinking that maybe being autistic, being dyslexic, and having ADHD is maybe not the detriment that we think so, and maybe it's a quality of a person that needs to be emphasized and put to work in the workforce. And I'm a big proponent of, I think that specifically to the topic of this show, I think a lot of people that end up in blue collar trades are incredibly intelligent. They just might be hindered by a learning disability. And to be honest with you, in the United States educational system, we are not very equipped to deal with those type of people. And they mostly always, like I do, find a workaround or modification. And they survive and thrive. And I think it's the blue collar trades that allows them to prosper the most. And so when people, I take it personally when people look down on blue collar trades, because that is what I've relied on to survive all my life. I always fall back. I can't do the bank jobs. I can't do that kind of stuff, but I can do the blue collar thing. And it's such that my mind works that way. And working in the oil field, I saw a whole bunch of other guys just like me that are doing amazing jobs, but they didn't fit in the educational system, but they fit in the oil industry and they welcome. And I think that's the same with agriculture. Those of us with disabilities are welcomed into the kind of blue collar jobs because we add a great amount of value to them, because a lot of value that was overlooked by other industries and other type of jobs. So I'm a big proponent. Be aware of the people with learning disabilities, especially in your autism, higher functioning autism scale, your dyslexics, your ADHD guys, that they can bring a tremendous amount of value if that energy is focused and directed in the right way.
I'm familiar with the particulars of ADHD, but what is dyslexia?
It is a lot about not being able to look at something and like, I can't, and a lot of times I will say words incorrectly. I don't even know what to do. And it's the wiring in my brain. I don't think anybody really knows how your brain gets organized. We're still learning how to do that, but I can't I do transcribe words. I can't sometimes if I'm in a panic. I have workarounds to tell Ryan left, but if I have to make a – if somebody's like, immediately you have to turn left, 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 I can't. I cannot put that together in my head. I can – if I have time to think about it, I can figure out left. But if it's something that I need to – my brain doesn't – can't pull that information together. So if it's an immediate thing and it's like you just have to go left and somebody's panicked about it, I can't do that. So – there is limitations that you have in dyslexia. And sometimes like I cannot, I'll have a word in my mind and I need to write it on paper and I just cannot do it. I cannot figure out the way that it needs to be put together to make it a whole. So if I have time to think about it, but sometimes I just have this brain block and it just doesn't happen. And I just have to take a deep breath. Realize this is something I have to work around. And like I said, there's technology to help you do that. But like I said, the advantages of having it are, I think that it gives me a unique ability to pull lots of information together that a lot of people don't have. So I come up with this happened all my life. And I've seen other people do it that have a learning disability, but really come up with novel solutions to problems just because they are accessing different portions of their brain. And I don't know how it all works, but I think that it's definitely works that way. And I had a guy I was visiting with, and he said, you know, all this dyslexics that you talk to wouldn't wish it on their children. And I don't have that perspective. I just assume that it's going to be a very big part of one of my children's lives. It might not be all of them, but they're going to have to deal with dyslexia. And I would prefer not to create a stigma around it. It's just something that's them, that's part of them, and they just need to learn and embrace it and see it as a strength and go forward. And I think that there's still a lot of stigma for adults that have it, maybe that didn't get it addressed and that kind of stuff. And I would like just to say that it's not a stigma, and you should just disregard people that think it's a stigma and try and find the benefits of it and celebrate those.
Right.
I mean, I still remember going into college classes and telling them, like, I need a little bit of extra time on my test, or, man, I hate multiple choice things because sometimes I mix the bubbles up. Like, I filled whole rows of bubble tests incorrectly just because, like, my brain got locked into a certain pattern. I mean, I was answering the questions, but I was B or D or something like that. I said, I can't do the bubble test, but I'll be happy to write a one-page report. And he goes, you know, this dyslexia, it's a bunch of BS. He goes, I'm not buying it. So you have the same opportunity as all the other people in the class. I'm not giving you any special dispensation. And that was back in the early 2000s. So it's just never, there's just some people that are just never going to believe that it is the benefit or it is a problem that it is. But I think that's lessening and lessening every year.
How does this affect you when you're doing technical work and, you know, working on things? Let's say you're going to, I don't know how deep you get into certain things, but let's say you're going to rebuild something. Do you find that to be much of an imposition?
It's interesting. I can understand the system. I can conceptualize the entire system probably better than most. But the little detail stuff, I have to really focus more on. I had a very technical job in the oil field that was running the tool that told the direction of the when they're drilling horizontally. And it was very technical. So I had to double check all the time. So I was weak that way. It comes naturally to a lot of people that they can get the numbers right every time. They have a quicker grasp on the numbers. Once I understood it, I probably understood the whole tool, the whole function of that tool better. And actually, a lot of times in my jobs, when I doing that kind of work, like fracking or drilling or I was trying to think of some of the other roles that I've had. Oh, managed pressure drilling. I'm a very slow learner at it. I don't pick it up fast, but I do. Once I do understand it, I understand it in its entirety. Just naturally, most of my jobs evolve to the point where, like, if there's something weird about this happening or something's odd or off or there's a problem, they're like, oh, yeah, send Richard over there. He'll get it straightened out. And I think that comes from being dyslexic. And I think once I understand it, then I can pull those things together and I can see the whole system a little bit better and sort of be able to troubleshoot it a little bit. It's an interesting dynamic. So does that answer your question?
It does. I mean, it's a complex issue.
Yeah.
And everything has its trade-offs and its pluses and its minuses. I myself, I'm on the spectrum somewhere. I've never been tested, but I know comparing myself to the quote normals that I am definitely different. I do transpose numbers a lot. I mean, literally, I can look at a number. I can look at a series of numbers where I'm comparing something and it's 4723 and all of a sudden I've turned it into 4732 and I'm looking, I'm like, there's not a match. And then I go back. Okay. Well, that's why, because I transpose it. It happens often enough with a regularity that I'm quite aware that that happens, even though, you know, it doesn't express itself linguistically, like with reading and spelling. I really do a pretty decent job, but with numbers, it impacts me. I would say that I have more of an ADHD issue. For me, I see it as a benefit because I can task switch immediately. I mean, I could be neck deep into something and you can approach me with something and I can, all the other stuff that I was working on drains from my mind and I'm already assimilating the new problem that I need to resolve. And it's so quick. Whereas other people might need a moment. Okay, hang on a second. Let me get, you know, they have a slower transition, but that doesn't mean that what they're doing isn't invaluable because they're working on something. They're staying task oriented. And I always feel like I've got 47 things pushing at me in my brain, trying to get attention, and I'm fighting it off, attempting to stay focused on the thing that I'm working on.
Right, right.
And so it has its pluses and minuses. And the people with ADHD were typically the people that could be leading a team out in the frontier, having to stay abreast of so many different issues coming at them, rather than the one guy that's doing his little task and that's all he focuses on. The ADHD guy is the guy that's, he's taking in a lot of inputs and he's sorting things out quickly.
Yes.
And at least that's what I tell myself.
Yeah, you need both. You need both sides of the coin. You need that guy that focuses on the details and knows the whole thing. But you also need that guy that can sit on a drill rig and run a crew and take care of the drill string. Or you need a guy that can be the superintendent on a paving job and know that what the trucks are doing and what his excavator operator's doing. And he has to worry about the grade. He has to worry about dealing with the ODOT guys. He's the point of all the everything that's happening on that job. Some people aren't good at dealing with that, and some people just live and thrive on that.
So what is your goals? I know you've talked about this on LinkedIn. You've talked about the dyslexia. What are your – do you have anything other than talking about this and bringing awareness? Do you have any other goals?
I just want to bring awareness to it. I want industries to realize the value of people – the learning disabilities and realize that they may have been leaning on them longer than they think. I see a lot of jobs being structured in the United States that sort of shy away from the blue collar type of people. They tend to trend more towards that person that can sit and focus. I don't think that's where the value. I think that a lot of the things that happen that add value in the United States is done by people with learning disabilities. And I just think that we need to recognize that. And I think if we start to recognize that and as a greater whole, as a greater society, then we can start making it more of a priority to help those people in the education system. We have two different types of people that we need to teach now, and not everybody can be taught the same way.
Right.
We need to recognize that we've been leaning on these people and sort of pushing them to the side and not celebrating the value and that they bring to the greater society as a whole. I just think that needs to be said, whether you have a disability as blue collar or not, or any type of worker in the United States. I think that the people that really drive and create value in this country are often the most overlooked and not focused on.
Well, before we started our industrial revolution, the people like you and the people that you're talking about that think a little bit differently were just part of society, and they were the people that went out and made things happen. As the industrial complex rose up and we needed people that would sit still and do repetitive jobs. And that's what the educational system that we still have the vestiges of today came from, was finding workers that would fit in the box and do the work they needed to do and just be mindless drones. The people like you and other people that don't fit in that box are not mindless drones. These are the people that are like, it's an antithesis to how they think, do, and act. And you are absolutely correct that in another time, in another age, these people would have been very, very valued as we switch to a gig economy, as we switch and we change how our society is being made, these types of people are going to be the kind of people that excel and really make a difference.
Oh, I completely agree. Yeah. I think that our next evolution is going to be like stepping away from those jobs that you're talking about, the industrial type jobs. I don't know what it's going to look like, but I think it's going to be a lot. I think that there's going to be a greater emphasis put on agriculture. I hope so anyways. I think that there's going to be a greater emphasis put on little, smaller type of companies that do specialized things, because we're not producing washer and dryers as much. I did just buy one manufacturer in the United States, but what we are doing is we're doing a lot of thinking for the world, and we're creating a lot of innovations and that kind of stuff. Like, it's just amazing the type of equipment that's coming out of the United States. If you look at the oil industry, the technologies that are being developed or that are really driving that industry forward are being developed in the United States. A lot of the agriculture, I had a big rant about agriculture technology, but that technology, a lot of it's innovated and thought of here in the United States. Australia, Finland, those kind of countries are contributing a lot to that. But we are really pushing the boundaries, and I think we can continue to do that. We just need to realize that maybe that's what we do now.
Creativity.
Yeah.
Well, Rich, we're going to wrap this up shortly, but I have another question for you. But before I get to that question, I'd like you to tell me anything that we haven't covered yet that you'd like to cover, that's been burning a hole, that you want to say.
I think you've given me a lot of opportunity to do that all through the podcast, so I appreciate that.
Okay.
Or maybe I just took it. I don't know.
Yeah, No. I freely gave, but you weren't shy about it. So all of this being said, let's go ahead and wrap up with the final question. After having this overview of where you've been, where you're currently, what do you want to achieve, do, look back on, and be glad you did in 20, 40, or more years from now?
I would like to have built and maintain. I'll step back. Agriculture is very much a generational type of endeavor. To build on agriculture, the current model is that it takes generations. So my great-great-grandfather came here from Ireland. He started with some sheep in San Francisco area. He migrated up into Oregon, and my grandfather built on that. He added land, he added cattle. Then my parents have built on that. They've added land, and they've added more cattle and knowledge that goes along with that many generations. So I would like to continue that tradition. I'd like to bring more people into that tradition and strengthen it. Yeah, so I'd like to say I build on that. I opened up some more land that wasn't open before, protected some wildlife. I made it a little bit better living for some people. So that would be my goal. It's not, I'm not after world domination. I just want to make a little bit of impact and pass on to my son and my partner's kids something that they can build on, and or something that will allow them to pursue whatever opportunities that they want to pursue. So there's always going to be somebody that needs to be here filling this role in agriculture. And if I can set up that next person to be successful, like the people before me set me up to be successful, then I think I will accomplish something wonderful.
That is awesome. Rich, had a great talk today. Thank you so much for coming on the Blue Collar Voices show. Definitely be seeing you online, and just thank you, sir.
Yeah, and thank you for this is a great endeavor, that your passion to expose all of us guys out on the fringe doing fringe jobs. I think it's incredibly important. I think it's stories that people want to hear. So kudos to you, man. I appreciate everything you do and your honesty in going about it.
Well, thank you so much. Rich, I will talk to you soon.
All right. Thank you.
The next episode of Blue Collar Voices brings to us Peter Early, who owns and operates Early Designs. Peter is a high-end wood craftsman specializing in high-end tables. Here is a very short clip from the recording.
And I apprenticed probably about six or seven guys through the shop. And some people think I'm crazy because I'm creating
competition.
But Yeah, I don't see it that way. I mean, there's so much to be done out there that even if we have 15 or 20 of me in this area, there's still plenty of work to do. It's just a matter of finding the right clientele, you know.
Hey guys, before you go, two things. The first is, I'm looking for more great guests for the Blue Collar Voices show. Basically, I'm looking for those that excel in the blue collar arena and have actually got their hands dirty, truly understanding what it is like to do the work. Now, the second thing, and exciting, hey, at least for me, I am planning a road trip. Phase one is building a list of locations to visit. Some locations will be just a meet and greet. Others will be on-site audio and or video. Please check out the website for more information. I'd love to hear from you. Email me at johnc@bluecollarvoices.com. You can also hit me up on LinkedIn. Thanks all. Looking forward to hearing from you. Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.